Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. And yes, those anti-federalists absolutely got it correct. This is Tom Navolis, your host, and I'm so delighted that you are here again with me this week. We are going to be talking about the mirrors of history in respect to everything that has been going on, in particular, these United States of America. We just have to take that look because I think we are living in a great confusion. If you take and you go to the website during this week, I put up an article regarding the cabaling cowards and the what I'm calling a moralist miscreants. And I'm specific to the state of Ohio in relationship to those that I'm identifying. But in fact, the principles that are coming from the writings of Samuel Adams, as well as who one of the writers are that we're going to be talking about today, is with a Mr. Beza. We're going to see that in so many ways, the facts, as I often say, go all the way back to the Old Testament, the dawn of man, the failure of our first parents, and the fact that Ecclesiastes 1:9 is always true. There's nothing new under the sun. And we're going to do another little tidbit of history there, because if you think, and I'm going to tell you right now, if you think that all of the corruption that we're seeing in Congress, through presidencies, through all of that in the 20th and 21st century are anything new, well, I'm going to take you to a website. The links are there at samueladamsreturns.net in the promo for today's program. And you'll see that, historically speaking, we've had some pretty interesting stuff going on. And if you're expecting anything out of the Durham report, if you're expecting any people to be held accountable for their evils that they have been perpetrating on this nation, well, you have false expectations. And history will prove it out by virtue of these articles that I'll share with you in the third segment today. So let's see, what are we going to cover in these mirrors of history? I want to take you back into that time of the 1500s, and that's where we'll be talking about Mr. Beza. And then I want to bring you up into the more modern time, if you will, of the 19th century, in the early 1800s, excuse me. In the 1800s is with Lord Acton. And then I'll bring you even into somewhere in this program here. If not, you'll find it in the references at samueladamsreturns.net, is what happened at CPAC last week. And as you can tell, I still have that sinus infection a bit going on. It takes a long time to clear that out for me, just because it's a sinus infection, and you know, it just takes a while. And I was hard down last week, so I did spend a lot of time watching CPAC in between sleeping and all of those other types of things you have to do when you're trying to get better. But let's jump into it. Let's get now into, let's go back a little bit further before Beza. Now, I don't know what is wrong with the American pulpits from a historical perspective. Now, I will tell you, I know what's wrong with American education and into the cemeteries. I mean, excuse me, the seminaries. I always slip up with that because, you know, I think that the seminaries have turned into cemeteries and we're actually producing the walking dead that go out into the pulpits now. So that's why we have a lot of dead churches. As I referred to last week, out of the 300 and some thousand churches, 70-odd% of them are what I call non-biblical. But With that in mind, where I want to start, which was taught, and I don't know if a lot of the modern evangelicals or have problems so much with the old Lutherans that they don't teach about Magdeburg any longer. So that's where we have to go. And you folks know that have been listening to the program for a long time that I have had Matt Truella on the program, and we've talked about the doctrine of the lesser magistrates, and people don't think that that's a doctrine. Well, it is. And I'm going to take you into some of that quickly into the section, and we may bleed into the second segment with that. But what I'm holding up in front of me right now on the video portion is the book, The Magdeburg Confession. And this was translated by Matthew Colvin, and it's very, very interesting. But let's set the stage for this, okay? The historical setting was back in 1517, obviously, with the 95 Theses that got hammered on the door. And later on, Charles V, if you well remember your history, those that can and where if you were taught, is that along the way, is that good old Charles V, he declared in 1521, and here's part of that, "For this reason, we forbid anyone from this time forward to dare, either by words or by deeds, to receive, defend, sustain, or favor the said Martin Luther. On the contrary, we want him to be apprehended and punished as a notorious heretic, as he deserves to be brought personally before us, or to be securely guarded until those who have captured him inform us, whereupon we will order an appropriate manner of proceedings against the said Luther, who will help in his capture, will be rewarded generously for the good work." Now, as you may know, there was a battle, there was wars that went on throughout Saxony. Well, the Prince of Saxony took and, you know, hid Luther and all of that. Things went on for a period of time. The Diet of Augsburg in 1530. Then it was kind of like a mechanism to try and cool things off. But then in 1531, there was Prince Philip and Prince John Frederick of Saxony. They said, no, we're not going to put up with this. And guess what? They went to war. And for 15 years, that went on. And then in June of 1546, Martin Luther died. Charles entered into an agreement with Pope Paul III in order to curb the spread of the Reformation, and in that agreement, in the name of the Holy, in the name of God, and with the help and assistance of His Papal Holiness, this Imperial Majesty should prepare himself for war and equip himself with soldiers and everything pertaining to warfare against those who object to the Council of Trent, against the Smalek League, and against all who were addicted to the false belief and error in Germany, and that he too, with all the power and might, in order to bring them back to the old faith and to the obedience of the Holy See." Interesting. So anyway, let's see, in 1546, they all went to war. They took defensive action. In 1547, at the Battle of Mühlberg, the League got their backsides kicked and conceded. And then things went on. There were these other interims in 1548, and it was unlawful to take and be a Protestant, period. Let's see. Philip Melanchthon, an heir apparent to Luther, he willingly compromised, believe it or not. And I like a lot of the things that Melanchthon wrote, but I'll tell you, he compromised. So it ended up that there was only one place in all of Germany that stood up to Charles V, and that was at Magdeburg. And Magdeburg laid under siege. And in that siege, it just continued. And finally, the pastors of Magdeburg wrote a defense of the position to standing in defiance of Charles V. And this is known as the Magdeburg Confessions, and that was in 1550. And in that, it is the secular leaders that agreed that their position biblically and through what is clear understanding of biblical truth, that they stand against the tyrant, Charles V, and all that was being done to Protestantism. Sets the stage. That sets the stage. So if you recall in your church history, and all those that went to cemeteries do not get this, is in fact that then at the same time we were seeing other areas of Protestantism coming to fruition. The Reformation was building. It was Luther that, you know, gave that impetus, but you have to understand there were things going on in other countries. And as we know, the biggest area of all things was there in Switzerland. And the one that was the prolific writer, if you will, the one that was coalescing a lot of that biblical thought was John Calvin. Now, Calvin, you know, I know that there's a lot of folks out there that, you know, just don't agree with Calvinism, but in the end, you know, if you're going to believe, and what I'm seeing today is that anything contrary to what we're talking about here in the resistance of tyrants, we're seeing so many different, and I'm interesting. And I mean, we're going to carry this over into the second segment because we're not going to get it finished, but we're going to carry over there and talking more about Bisa and all of that. But I want to continue to lay this groundwork from taking that historical snapshot of what happened in Lutheran Germany and the fact that the rest of what was going on as the Reformation was developing and coming into its own during that period of time, is that what we see now across America in those denominations, those churches that actually have a biblical worldview, is that people aren't sitting on their rooftops anymore. They're saying, wait a minute, we have rights. We have God-given rights, unlike Canada has government-given rights, big difference. And most of the other countries across the world have government-given rights, not God-given rights like we secure here in these United States. Now, with that, what that means is that based on your theological, eschatological perspective, we walked away for a good 100 years within the context of the churches, and people have been looking for the rapture. They have been looking for Jesus to come back. Well, I don't know if you know it, but you know what? They were looking for Jesus to come back all the way into the first century church. Now, as I always say, and I'm going to take this as we only have a minute and a half left, my perspective from that Puritan Reformation point of view is Jesus is only going to be coming back for his pure bride, his clean bride, a bride with a white dress, not a dirty bride. So we have a lot that we need to clean up. We need to reform within ourselves personally, and then within our churches as well. But what that means is that in America, we took the road of a, quote, theological position to the extent that we had so many rooftop Christians, as I have always called them for decades, people sitting on a rooftop waiting for Jesus to come back, so never getting involved in that which we are commanded to get involved, which the Magdeburg Confession, especially for those that go to office or educators or any position of authority, have a right to exercise. And not only that, I have to think about this so I say it correctly, not only that, God has given us all the mechanisms within the U.S. Constitution to be able to exercise a fullness of the complete biblical gospel in the same manner that they did at the founding of the nation. So as we close out this first segment, You know, Sam Adams understood that as his moniker being the last Puritan, he understood those Reformation principles and concepts. So come on back for the next segment and we'll continue on. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second segment of Samuel Adams Returns. And this is Tom Navolis, your host. So we're going to pick up with where I left off in the first segment, being that for 80 to 100 years or so, we have chosen in America to leave those fundamental, especially out of New England, and what happened with the first Great Awakening, biblical concepts and worldview, that we have every right to resist tyrants. And instead, because of the theological shifts and changes, especially as it went into the mid-1800s, and we had the social gospel that came into fruition, that we stepped away from resistance to tyrants. And in fact, the churches have become promoting tyrants. And as we've seen, and I had a couple weeks ago in one of the programs where the evangelicals actually helping promote the tyranny here in America by key evangelical leaders. Now, isn't that amazing? Well, it's not to me. It may be to you, but it's not to me, because if you follow church history and you go back to the foundational Reformation history, and even more so, if you go back to that which I always talk about, that first Great Awakening, then you will see that we always had the churches like the Church of England of the day, that what they did is they kowtowed as leftovers from the divine right of the king concept. And as a result, the Tories and the Tory churches were very much in favor of continuing that form of a political hierarchy and political submission, even within the context of the church, because there was such a nice, cozy relationship there. And as we saw with Charles V, the cozy relationship that he had with the Pope at that time, very, very interesting. And as it is something that I mentioned last week, and something again that I wrote in the article that I talk to you about, and I'll reference that, or it is referenced in the program here, is that there is this intimate tie between religion and liberty, because the intimate tie is the fact that Jesus Christ, the God of all eternity, created liberty within himself. So our true liberty is only within that aspect of how we understand our biblical truth. So that biblical worldview, that solid Reformation biblical worldview, is one that allows us to understand true liberty. So let's continue on as I was talking about Magdeburg, and that they stood up, they understood that, they wrote the letter. That was the Lutheran perspective. Now, let me take you into another step of history, if you will. I want to take you again. Now, this is only, 20-some years later, all right? Let's look at this. 20-some years later. And that 20-some years later would say August 24th, 1572. Now, so we went from 1550 to 1572. Good math says 22 years. Does anybody remember St. Bartholomew's Day? St. Bartholomew's Day. Wow. This happened, at that time, the French Catholics were taking and were celebrating St. Bartholomew's Day, and quite frankly, the Protestants at that time were. Now, there was this real rub in France. It was called the Huguenots. They were, at that time, and they still exist, are a French Protestant Calvinistic group. And they were taking and, you know, celebrating. They were living. They were a large population through all of France. And guess what? They had strong political power in France at the time. But more importantly, let me make this clear. They were the craftsmen. The Huguenots not only had some wealthy individuals, people that were in the trading industry, you know, shipbuilding, had political families that with great wealth and all of that. Not only did they have that, but a great majority of the Huguenots were, yeah, the clockmakers, the shoemakers, the builders, the contractors, all of that. Well, the French Catholics didn't particularly care for that. And in particular, the King of France's mother despised them and the leadership. So lo and behold, on this great Saint Bartholomew's Day in 1572, there was a bloody massacre. The queen, through her agents, released the onslaught, and that just in one day alone, thousands of Protestants were slaughtered, murdered, men, women, children, families, slaughtered on St. Bartholomew's Day in Paris alone. Over the course of that year, there were over 1 million Huguenots that were just massacred there in France. Now, anybody remember that history? Does anybody remember St. Bartholomew's Day? I think we're going to have to take and really put that up just as an idea of remembrance on August 24th. And should be interesting. So I'll have to think about that. Maybe I'll pull that program back up on at that period of time in August. So there were a lot of pamphlets being written then by all of the other, even the Lutherans were writing on that. The Calvinists started writing about it. And it was just this major, major outcry and a monochromatic political theory was brought forward. It was called the Huguenot Resistance Theory or the Calvinist Resistance Theory. And the legal arguments were really brought into play in that whole Western political thought. And what came out of it in these pamphlets then takes and brings us to the piece that was written by Theodore Bissa. Theodore Bissa, he was the one that Calvin actually on his deathbed said, Bissa's going to replace me. He's going to be the one that will take the leadership there in Switzerland in all that was happening in Geneva. And the Geneva pastor. Well, anyway, he wrote at that time then on the rights of magistrates by Theodore Bissa. And in this, in what it is in the detail, and I'm going to get, there's a reference in here to a very good a paper that was written by this gentleman by the name from Union Theological Seminary, is Russ Gazdia, and he wrote this in the spring of 2014. Very good article. I love the summation here. So it gives you some of that context. But when we take and we start looking at the significance of the fact that we are called, and you see it all through Scripture. In fact, people go, oh, no, you know, there's nothing there. We know that Romans says that you just bow down, and First Peter says you just do whatever the your leaders tell you. Well, that's not true. Not true at all. So in respect to the time that we have in these last 5 minutes, you can take and go and read this full article that this gentleman wrote on the rights of the magistrates. I think it has great historical context. He breaks it down very nicely. But let's just take a look at what Beza wrote himself. And I think in the last 5 minutes here, we need to be able to digest and we need to understand the argument in that there are examples throughout the Old Testament, and that one of the areas that Beza brings out is a first question in all the other questions. So let me take you to Beza's writing himself. He has a first question being, must magistrates always be obeyed as unconditionally as God? Second, is a magistrate held responsible to render account for all his laws to his subjects? And how far are they to presume such laws to be just? Another question, how far must obedience be rendered or refused to unjust or impious commands? How can one who has suffered wrong at the hand of a ruler defend himself against him? Whether manifest tyrants can lawfully be checked by armed forces, and what is the duty of subjects toward their superiors who have fallen into tyranny? Now, in my presentations on the lesser magistrate and the other programming, we discuss a lot of that, especially from some modern writers who have done some really nice deep dives into all of that. But let's take and drive into this a little bit deeper, just in that first question, because we only have 3 minutes left in this segment, and I do want to talk about Acton and a little bit about CPAC. But let's go into here just alone what Beza writes in the first question. The first question being, must magistrates always be obeyed as unconditionally as God? And that, you know, so many people say that, well, that's the Romans 13, and that's the First Peter saying that, you know, we're supposed to obey our leaders as we obey God. And he's asking that question. And here's his answer. Inasmuch as only the will of Almighty God is the eternal and immutable rule of all justice, we declare that it must be unconditionally obeyed. However, as regards the obedience due to princes, elected leaders, whomever is in authority, they too would doubtless have to be obeyed always and unconditionally if, operative word, if they ruled constantly in accordance with the utterances of God. Since, however, theirs is often the contrary case, such obedience must be made subject to the following condition. Namely, that they command nothing impious, nothing unjust. I call impious or sinful those which God forbids in the first tablet of his law, or of which forbid those which God commands there. However, I call unjust behest those which either prevent or forbid the performance of that which every man, in accordance with his calling, either public or private, is bound to render to his neighbor in charity. And he continues, and we'll have to pick it up in the third segment, and we'll be short on Acton and real short on CPAC. But he goes on and brings in a whole rational argument from the perspective that it's not going to be difficult to do that. For the Lord says that by his prophet Isaiah, I will not give my glory to another. So when it comes into the context as we look at our present day rulers, especially those in any administration, whether it's at the state, federal, county, city level, if they're not following what was defined there as, do you believe and execute even just the Ten Commandments? Do you allow those to be the substance of truth? Do you allow them to be taught in schools so that we have a moral people? Remember, as John Adams and Madison said, this Constitution for these United States of America is only for a moral and virtuous / religious people. Come on back in the third segment with Sam Adams Returns. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Samuel Adams Returns. And this is the third segment. And for those of you that missed the second segment, because we do take and combine our first and second segment for a lot of the other programming out there that we are participating in. And once again, welcome to all of you there in St. Louis Market. It's a delight to be with you, an honor to do so. With that, if you missed that second segment, please go to SamuelAdamsReturns.net, where all of the archives for the programming are, and you can get the full podcast as well if you're interested. You can see my smiling face there on video. So once again, for those that are watching over my shoulder here on the left side, SamuelAdamsReturns.net. And there, again, you can get all the references for today's program because I highly reference everything that I bring to you. So in that, I wanted to just do a real quick wrap for those that missed the last segment, is that what we were talking about is Theodore Bisa taking and writing about the rights of magistrates. And what he had to say there, just on the first question alone, and that first question being, must magistrates always be obeyed as unconditionally as God? And we know that what led to here in America, the American transition away from Great Britain is because the founding fathers, if they understood, which they did, and read the Reformation writers and the historical writers, clearly understood that the answer to that question is no. And Bisa outlines that in detail from a full biblical and rational perspective as to why not. So if we had the rooftop Christians during our founding era, we would have never broken away from England as we have rooftop Christians over the last 100 years that allowed all of this evil to be propagated here in the United States. So moving on, that first question was answered, and Bisa gets there both this writing by Theodore Bisa on the rights of the magistrate is in those references at SamuelAdamsReturns.net. There's all the different references that are there that we are speaking about today. So let's jump real quick into Lord Acton, because I think what Lord Acton does here very, very well is that he takes and gives a lot of actions in history. And he wrote, as part of all of his history writings, the history of freedom in Christianity. And this is basically book two, the history of freedom in Christianity. And as you go through that, what's really, really interesting to me is, like, not far into this, he gets to this paragraph. And I want to read this for you because I think it's something that is kind of interesting in relationship to how did Christianity also become so prolific and what influences did it have in the political realm? Because as I mentioned earlier in the second segment, is that our liberties and political life are tied completely to what is happening in our religious health. And as we know right now, there is poor religious health in America, so we don't have what we need for leadership. So as it always, the Bible says, you know what? The people suffer for what? Lack of knowledge, but lack of leadership. When the leaders are evil, guess what? The people suffer. So interesting. So Constantine, as Acton writes, declared his own will equivalent to a canon of the church. Get that? Let's see, what do we have here with in modern America with all of the mandates, all of the different types of bureaucratic insanities, all of that which is thrust upon us? To me, it's like, you know, the will of the government is equal to the canon law of the church. So they're making it equivalent to the Bible. So, you know, this is where Constantine declared his own will equivalent to the canon law. According to Justinian, the Roman people had formally transferred to the emperors the entire plenitude of its authority, and therefore the emperor's pleasure, expressed by edict or by letter, had force of law. So let me bring that into some parallelisms for you right now. What we have is dictate by bureaucracy and dictate by executive order. Now, this has been going on even prior to none other than Franklin D. Roosevelt. So it's not a new phenomena. It was in that time. Even let's take it back to Abraham Lincoln, was an abuser of executive power, as well as that what happened in establishing the bureaucracies that were established in those 1800s and how they flowed and expanded and did everything that the Anti-Federalists predict would happen when you start to give government and bureaucracies and designing men, and in modern times, women, the ability to do and exercise all that they wish to do. So what we have now in this parallel, if you will, to this history that Lord Acton is talking about is that Congress, both the House and Senate, are cowards. And what they do is they have given over the power of the people, the power of Congress, the power of the states, because the Senate no longer represents the states the way they're supposed to under the 17th Amendment. And therefore, power has been given to the bureaucracies, the government, the new Constantine. Now, also, they have never put the proper checks in on the executive branch. And the judicial branch is just kind of motoring along, you know, and they play politics as well. So what we have, and we're not going to be able to get into all the context of this, again, your reference for this is in SamuelAdamsReturns.net for today's program, is that what we have here is that you, the emperor or the government in our case, you know, the force of law is there. And the bad part is the bureaucracies now in modern times, they do set what? They set rules that are enforceable as law. So even in the fervent age of this conversion, the empire employed its refined civilizations, the accustomed wisdom of ancient sages, the reasonableness and subtlety of Roman law, and the entire inheritance of the Jewish, the pagan, and the Christian world to make the church serve as a gilded crutch of absolutism. So absolutism today is the new Green Deal, environmentalism, CRT, SEL. Oh, talking about SEL, that's social emotional learning. At the end of the month, and as we get in here, is that we are going to have a great panel discussing social emotional learning, and it'll be pretty much Ohio centric, but it's applicable because the whole thing is a mess across the whole country. And the one thing that you need to understand here, anybody that is listening in Christian radio world, social emotional learning is being implemented inside Christian education. And I'll tell you right now, social emotional learning should be taught by parents and the church itself, not in education the way that is. Social emotional learning is the destruction of the family. And if evangelicals and your Christian school is implementing it, you are instituting the destruction of the family. All right, enough said there. Wait till the panel comes up. And oh, talking about education, also we will be having a president of a Christian college on the program. I'll be interviewing him, so stay tuned for that. That's going to be real, real good too. So anyway, you have this whole thing of the old inheritance of Jewish, the pagan, and the Christian world. It comes together, and it serves as that gilded crutch of absolutism in government. Neither an enlightened philosophy nor all the political wisdom of Rome, nor even the faith and virtue of the Christians availed against the incorrigible tradition of antiquity. Something was wanting beyond all the gifts of reflection and experience, the faculty of self-government and self-control developed like its language in the fiber of a nation and growing with its growth. The vital element, which may be centers of warfare, of anarchy, of oppression, had extinguished in the countries that were still draped in the pomp of ancient civilization, was deposited on the soil of Christendom by the fertilizing stream of migration that overthrew the empire of the West. Now he goes on in talking about how the Romans were this race that abdicated everything to the hands of the monarch. We do that as well, and taking an understanding that, oh, we're supposed to just bow down to the government. What I talked about Magdeburg, what I talked about Beza, do we just give it all over? When we elect people, so here's where I'm going to go off in the direction now, because there's a lot in this, in Christianity, in history. And the reality that where it matured to was not only Magdeburg, but where it matured to was the Declaration of Independence. Or maybe before that, let's talk about Magna Carta, where it set up the establishment of people being the sovereigns within the nation, taking back from governing authorities, self-governance. And what does that mean then in relationship to everything else that is rightfully given in the ideas of property and all else? I mean, go back and look at the Old Testament when the tribes entered into Cana. What was given? Property, every tribe, and distributing within that land to the people. You know, they just didn't huddle up in big, you know, tent cities. There were cities, but you know what? Land has always been important, and property in that of self-governance and what you do with it. How do you act? What's that relationship? But now let's take that and look back at Constantine and Rome and the reality that by taking and just allowing our elected officials to do whatever they please once they're elected, and you think that your only duty is to go to the poll. No, that's not it. Not in America, folks. I've talked about it in many other programs. Our duty, especially if you are a Christian, our duty is to be continuously vigilant and active. Oh, but Tom, we have all this life we have to do. We have to go to work. We have our kids. We have this. We have that. We have that. Well, you know what? You have to self-govern at home. You have to understand that governance in your family. And that's why it's important as we come out in a week or so, maybe a couple of weeks, with the panel on social emotional learning, that you can't give that up, not only in the public schools, it's a big issue there, but the bigger issue is that you're implementing it in the Christian schools. And that's a destruction of family. That's taking, again, away your responsibility as a parent to self-govern and build that greater community within the context of what? A biblical reformed environment, a biblical worldview, and the foundations of this great nation. Sam Adams knew that. Sam Adams homeschooled his kids until he sent them on. Sam Adams was involved in education. Sam Adams, yes, he is. This is Sam Adams Returns. Samuel Adams returns with you next week as well.